When we think about how to help Africa, the problems seem insurmountable. Malaria, AIDS, hunger, poverty, civil war, each issue seems intractable. One issue that underlies them all is often missed: infrastructure. Water, power, roads, electricity, telecommunications, basic practical matters that are critical to economic development. In too much of Africa, infrastructure is either crumbling or non-existent. Today, we're going to focus on two key areas: roads and telecommunications. Highways and passable roads are vital to trade, both to get goods to ports, to get them overseas, and within the continent itself. Bad roads contribute to a shocking incident of traffic deaths. Telecommunications are just as important, and in many countries where landlines are impractical, cell phones are beginning to transform people's lives. Corruption, civil insecurity, disease, and poverty are still major factors. Today, a look at the promise and the problems of infrastructure in Africa. Later in the program, a history lesson from an anti-immigration campaign in the 1930s and a remembrance of pop star Gene Pitney, the man who shot Liberty Valance, remember? But first, practical help in Africa. If you're investing your time and money in Africa, or if you've traveled there, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Our first guest is Stephen Morrison. He's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much, Neil. Happy to be here.
In preparation for this program, I read a statistic which astonished me. The mileage of paved roads is just a few years ago in Africa, outside of South Africa, was less than the mileage of paved roads in the country of Poland, which is about the size of Zimbabwe.
Yes, those are startling facts, and if you can go through many countries in Africa where you have weak states or where you've had civil unrest and the like, and you can look at the statistics in terms of paved roads or roads that are workable in, at some level, and you can find that actually the numbers compare very negatively against the colonial era as well, which is a very startling and disturbing fact.
Hard enough to build these structures in the first place. Also difficult to have the money to maintain them.
Right. This has been one of the big dilemmas for road and port infrastructure, as well as power infrastructure in Africa. Is that when there were big investments made in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s in these sectors. Where it was much more fashionable in terms of foreign aid to be putting money into these large projects, they proved to be non-sustainable. They proved to be very expensive in order to maintain and preserve and keep them going. Oftentimes you didn't have a sufficient state fisc, a tax base, nor did you have the maintenance bureaucracy and capacity to keep them going. There was a tendency to move them off of bilateral donor programs into multilateral donor programs, mm-hmm. where they came to be a bigger priority with some specialization in water and the like.
Yep.
And even there, you had a fall off of interest over time as it became clear how difficult they were. Then when you had the end of the Cold War, of course, there was a broader disengagement for a period from Africa in the 90s, and there again you had a further diminution of interest and much greater focus today on really the private sector coming in and having a role. And now, of course, the Chinese have emerged and others as major players operating with a slightly different model around mm-hmm. infrastructure. So there's a whole new debate around infrastructure in Africa.
Well, let me just ask you a question. I mean, there seems to be a perception that most of the money that is sent to Africa is to resolve these crises, hunger, malnutrition, disease, as opposed to things like infrastructure. Is that accurate?
Well, it's true that if you just look at the U.S., foreign assistance program, the bilateral foreign assistance program. The U.S. is consistently investing around $1 billion a year in emergency humanitarian programs. But of late, in the last few years, and this is a surprising development, you see a return to much higher development assistance commitments by the U.S. government, including when you have the creation of the Millennium Challenge Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
A new interest in putting significant resources against infrastructure in countries, in select countries that are seen as good performers on both economic and political grounds. And so you see now countries like Benin, Senegal, Ghana, Madagascar, countries which are seen as on the path to reform and deserving and capable of coming forward with large-scale plans for upgrading their infrastructure, getting, you know, now being in the queue, if not already awarded, major grants towards infrastructure.
Telecommunications in Africa is gaining a lot of momentum these days, no longer seen as a luxury for developing countries, but as a prerequisite for economic growth. Joining us now by phone from here in Washington, D.C. is Mohammed Ibrahim. He's the chairman of the board of Celtel. Nice of you to be with us today.
Hello.
Tell us why cell phones have become so universally popular in Africa.
Well, mobile phones really fill in a gap which is really needed. Over 100 years of operation, the fixed operators really failed to provide Africa with credible infrastructure, mainly because of lack of investment and mismanagement, overemployment, etc. And the cell phones came really to fill in a huge gap, and it proved to be very successful, and we build the infrastructure without resort to aid or help from anybody, and actually we build successful businesses there.
Successful businesses? So this is private all?
Yes, absolutely private.
And wireless, is wireless easier to develop than the old system of landlines with towers?
Absolutely. Given the distances in Africa, I mean, Africa really is a huge continent, and many African countries are, you take the Congo or Sudan, or these are bigger than the whole of Western Europe. It's very difficult and uneconomic to bury copper throughout that. Wireless proved to be the solution. The cost per subscriber for developing advanced wireless GSM network there is well below $150 per subscriber. It costs three times that to build a fixed operation.
I understand that it has been especially helpful to people in rural areas, farmers, who are suddenly able to contact, they're not limited to just the person who comes around to buy their crops, they can get prices from town.
It's absolutely. It is essential for everybody. Africa is huge. I mean, I always say equity. What is the equity in a phone call? What is the value of a phone call? If you are in D.C. here or in New York or somewhere, you can send a letter to pass information to somebody. You are sure it's going to be arrived next morning. You can use a fixed line. You can pick up a taxi, a cab, and go there. You can use underground. But none of these alternatives are available in Africa. None of these are working. So the equity of a phone call is extremely valuable. It saves so much in fuel and time in just to communicate from one place to another. And this is correct for a fisherman, as is correct. A fisherman, at the end of the day, wants where to land his catch, you know. He phones three or four harbors and find what is the price of sea bass here, what is the price of tilapia there, and he goes and sell over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer possible to con people into, you know, the role of the middleman dictating the market price is finished. And
yet your investment is in itself pretty risky. As I understand it, for example, you were erecting a network, cell phone towers and whatnot, in Sierra Leone in the middle of a civil war.
Yes, we done that in DRC. We done that. What is happening? I think people over-exaggerate what is happening in Africa. Yes, there is strife in one or two countries. There is a problem here or there, but that is a huge place. Nobody says Europe is unsafe because there is a problem in Bosnia. And that is the issue in Africa. Not everywhere in Africa there is conflict. When there are conflicts, they are contained in central areas. Even in the areas of conflict, combatants don't poison water wells, which we know both sides will need to drink from. This is the etiquette of war.
So in the same way, they're not going to knock down cell phone towers.
Everybody live off telecommunication.
Well, there've been some.
None of our towers were touched. None of have never lost a single dollar in infrastructure throughout this year. And we operate in 14 African countries. 14. in sub-Saharan Africa.
I regret to say, I think there are examples of wells being poisoned, but nevertheless, it is a risky investment, high risk, high return, quite lucrative.
Right. I would really argue it was not high risk. I am happy that it was perceived high risk because this kept the big operators out of Africa because they perceived it is too risky. That gave chance to small companies. So I'm very grateful for those guys who thought it was risky.
I've read a quote.
Between you and me, it was not risky.
I've read a quote from you that this is the first time in your career in which your heart and your wallet have been in the same place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the job is done in Africa was wonderful. We created so many high quality jobs, direct employment. Then indirect employment, because we use scratch cards, prepaid systems, all our customers have to go out in the morning to buy scratch cards. And, of course, in 14 countries we have, there is a business of about $3 billion a year. There is 120,000 points of sale. Can you believe that? 120,000 points of sales. How many entrepreneurs sprang out for action in our 14 countries? These are all private businesses.
Mohammed,
people who build our towers, the people who fuel them, the batteries, a lot of jobs was created around us.
Mohammed Ibrahim, thank you very much. We know you're busy and have to run off to a meeting. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Mohammed Ibrahim, chairman of Celtel, Africa's largest pan-African wireless company. He joined us today by phone from here in Washington, D.C. We did want to get the chance to speak with him before he went away to make another speech, and therefore we'll have to start with your calls after we come back from a break if you'd like to join the conversation about infrastructure in Africa, both the promise and the problems. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about Africa, specifically the practical aspects of economic development, including roads, telecommunications, infrastructure. With us is Stephen Morrison, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Of course, you're welcome to join us as well. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Now let's go right to the phones. This is Chris. Chris calling us from Lansing, Michigan.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, and then I was a journalist doing freelance for BBC all around West Africa, and I drove my motorcycle linking village to village crossing borders.
You're a brave man, Chris.
I had some fun, and I'm not as brave anymore. But one of the things you think of is, where can I get a nice, clean road to drive on? And usually the best roads, if they were just done, usually by like a French or a foreign Italian road construction company, were only about 2 inches thick. Now, if you can imagine a road that's got to handle a bunch of trucks, within a couple of weeks of making a brand new road that's 2 inches thick, it's already broken up. Just a snapshot there.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Morrison, would you say that's accurate?
It's accurate in many poor countries. It's not just limited to Africa, but perhaps it's more pronounced where budget considerations limit you. If you were to drive around the outskirts of any major metropolitan area in Ethiopia, for instance, where you have very severe climate changes in the course of a year and you have lots of roads washed out every year and you have to go back and do major repair and you have very long distance heavy trucking patterns, you get into a habit of simply refinishing them on a mm-hmm. superficial basis with the full expectation you're going to be back doing this again in another 9 to 12 months.
Another of those sobering statistics I was reading in preparation for this program, traffic fatalities per 10,000 vehicles in the 10 most developed countries in the world is something like 2.3. In Africa, it was 339. Chris, that's why I said, Chris, you have to be a brave person to drive a motorcycle on some of those roads.
Yeah, there's a fellow Peace Corps volunteer from Niger, a guy named Peter Chilson. I'll plug his book. He's a good buddy, and he wrote a great book called Riding the Demon on the Road in West Africa. the harrowing taxi rides that he took, he made a book out of, because so much of people's life and death are staked out in the road.
Chris, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's turn to Zelato. Zelato, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is with us from Seattle.
Correct. I was born in Africa, near, and also one big part in Africa is that we, with all actually the corrupt government there, and I am embarrassed to say that from there, but I wish the European and U.S. Western nations perhaps come hard on that. They instead look the other way and let it happen to people. But people are there, same anywhere, but the government's corruption there everywhere in Africa is creating this ongoing problem.
Is corruption, Stephen Morrison, a difficulty when you're trying to erect these very expensive projects, roads, telecommunications, things like that?
Well, certainly any major infrastructure project, if it's roads or ports or power generation, where you're putting out huge contracts, has the very, very strong invitation for corruption, and so it requires very strong oversight. And the gentleman Zelato's comment is one that's made very often.
Mm-hmm.
The counter to that is to point out the many different points of promise in Africa and elsewhere, where governments have come to power with a very strong determination to curb corruption, and where donors have begun to put money behind those governments which are showing a record of achievement and are willing to begin to re-engage on infrastructure because they have a higher level of confidence.
Hmm.
This is certainly true when you look at the Millennium Challenge Corporation and the approach taken in places like Benin in the trying to clean up the corruption around the port and road system in and around that site.
And Zelato, as we heard earlier from Mohamed Ibrahim and just now from Stephen Morrison, Africa's a big place. Not every place is as bad as every other.
I agree, and I thank you for having Mr. Mohamed Ibrahim. He is one of the very respected entrepreneurs there. We need, I'm myself an entrepreneur. We need more of them help that devastated continent, I should say.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
Good luck. Let me ask you, you mentioned earlier, Stephen Morrison, the Chinese who are investing in a lot of economic development, particularly extraction in terms of materials in which they want to use in for manufacture in China and that sort of thing. What kinds of projects are they involved in? Why are they involved in it?
Well, the Chinese have, along with the Indians, Malaysians, South Koreans, are coming into Africa and have been now in a very accelerated pace in the last few years. They're coming in search of scarce commodities in the energy, hard rock minerals, and the like. They're coming in to strike political relationships, and they're coming in to make investments and to engage in trade, and they're putting a much bigger emphasis on infrastructure, unlike what we've seen from the Western donors.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is that they come in a packaged approach. The business model that might be applied by a Western European or North American donor or private investor in how they go about doing their business is quite different with respect to the Chinese. The Chinese are making a very long-term generational investment in these countries. They believe that they will be generating jobs for their own corporations, which often come in with the laborers and with the inputs. So there's a very direct home-tied benefits to their own industries. They believe, in some cases, that they can bring strong controls over the quality of what they produce. But they've also been criticized in many places for low quality in the construction standards that they have pursued.
There's also been accusations that they are less concerned, perhaps, with human rights and corruption than Western governments. Is that accurate, or is that sour grapes?
Well, they've come under very strong criticism, deservedly so. With respect to the Sudan and their indulgences of Mugabe in Zimbabwe. I think, though, we have to be careful in looking at the and in making categorical statements at this point about Chinese behavior in Africa, because the Chinese are making very sizable investments in places like Nigeria and Angola and elsewhere, and I don't believe they have an interest in seeing those investments squandered in a short period of time. That will only burn out the goodwill for them and their own interest in continuing, and as I said earlier, this is a long-term generational investment that they're making.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller in. Sarah's with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hi, I am an undergrad at FSU, and I'm studying telecommunications. And speaking about the infrastructure, the telecommunications, I guess I was wondering, what is the protection of the underprivileged people here? Is there a safeguard against this money coming in and creating sort of a huge capitalistic machine? And, you know, the people who maybe can use the Internet for help won't be getting it, and they're just worried about food. What are some of the, what can these elements of the infrastructure bring to less privileged people instead of just sort of an economic capitalist machine, foreigners?
David Morrison?
Okay, let's look at two pieces of this question. On the cell phone technology and the rather remarkable and surprising spread of that technology into poor settings in Africa, it's had a very broad democratizing and leveling impact in the sense that poor people have demonstrated their interest in picking up that technology, making it part of their lives, and it's been affordable. And in that sense, you can say it's had a liberating and empowering impact. In bringing greater economic life, economic vitality, access to information and the like. It has not yet, though, translated into really broad, equitable access to the Internet in the same way that it has in other settings like in Asia. And that has to do with the enduring limitations in terms of infrastructure on technology side within Africa as compared to many places in Asia and the like. Now, on the other question on roads, let's take the Chad-Cameroon pipeline as an example. Here is an instance where oil corporations, the World Bank, NGOs come together with the government of Chad and put together a $3.7 billion pipeline to bring oil forward. And the earnings from the oil are supposed to be dedicated towards schools, education, road building, and the like for broad beneficial impacts. Now, this has been going on for about a year and a half. It's in a bit of crisis right now. There's been a lot of questions around the equity. Some of the most recent investigations in the New York Times and elsewhere have shown that, in fact, the big contracts on road construction that have come out of that experiment, which is a very promising experiment, have, in fact, lined the pockets of relatives of President Deby of Chad and raised the whole question that Sarah brings forward, which is, at the level of this average citizen, how much benefit actually accrues to that citizen in terms of access to well-paved roads that weren't there before that could connect them to markets. So even under the most carefully managed projects, things can go off the rails.
Sarah, thanks for the question.
Thank you.
Joining us now is someone who also knows a bit about roads. Eloho Otobo is chief of the Policy Analysis and Monitoring Unit in the Office of the Special Advisor for Africa at the United Nations. He joins us now by telephone from New York City. Very good of you to join us today, sir.
Thank you very much.
And I wanted to ask you about some of the projects that Stephen Morrison was just referring to. The difficulty of building such capital-intensive projects in these regions, it's daunting.
Absolutely. It's daunting from three perspectives. It's daunting from the point of view of mobilizing the finances, and I think he gave the figure of $3.7 billion as the cost of that project. It's also daunting from the point of view of managing them, and it's daunting from the point of view also of building partnership. Nonetheless, the size of the challenge or the scale of the challenge should not be an excuse for inaction. And I think the pipeline project, which you talked about, and other projects underway under the NOPOD auspices does underline the commitment of African leaders to grapple with that challenge.
The importance of these projects cannot be underestimated. Again, reading statistics, there is the difficulties of internal transportation within the continent of Africa has been described as adding like a 10% tariff to every African export.
Right. Absolutely, and that is even truer of the landlocked least developed countries. As you know, quite a number of African countries are landlocked, and these landlocked countries have to transit through what you call the coastal states, and that means that the cost you just identified is in fact mostly with those landlocked countries that have these greater constraints on transportation. For the coastal states, the problem is less so. But having that having been said, it's also true even for the coastal state that in some cases they find it difficult to move goods from their hinterland right to the coast. So the key challenge to be addressed here is improved road transportation, and where possible, rail. Some of the countries have rail line which have suffered from bad maintenance policies. Therefore, it's a two-track approach that we are talking about that can revive that. One, maintain the existing rail and road links and build new ones in order to get goods from the hinterland at a cheaper cost.
We're talking today about infrastructure in Africa. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Eric. Eric's with us from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah, this is Eric from Cincinnati. I'm an African from Ghana.
But,
and I want to thank you and your guests for at least identifying the few success stories in Africa, and that it's not a continent or, I mean, a miserable continent. Now, in addition to that, what I want to say is that I think it's about time Africans take ownership of their problems and reduce their dependency on Western countries, which support them all the time come in. I remember one time on your program you discussed about pharmaceutical companies spending more on potential drugs than on tropical diseases.
Yes.
This shows that if we don't take ownership of our problems, nobody's going to solve it for us. Nobody's going to come in. Look at what's happening in Sudan and Niger and all those places. People are dying. We have to come up with solutions to help ourselves rather than depending on Western countries to pour out, I mean, manna from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Erica. But let me ask both of our guests, isn't this to some degree a chicken and the egg problem? You need large capital to begin some of these huge infrastructure projects. Where else is that capital going to come from? Of course, if you have them, then maybe Africa can start its own development and generate more income of itself. Mr. Otobo?
Yeah, well, you see, first of all, let me reply to the last caller, because he said something which is interesting about the ownership. He's from Ghana, and Ghana is an exemplary country, both in the Nepal context. It's the first country that has completed the peer review mechanism under the African peer review under the APRM, which was initiated under NEPAD. And ownership is the central organizing principle of NEPAD. Now, it is true, historically, if you look at the economic history of all the countries, including your own country, United States,
mm-hmm.
when a country is at a developing stage, there is no question that they will need foreign capital. When the United States was developing, it needed money from England. At that time, England was the United Kingdom was the financial hegemon. So there is no inherent incompatibility between ownership and looking for external resources. I think what would be a pity is to be completely and perpetually dependent on external resources. But insofar as those capital come, either in loan or whatever form, I don't see any incompatibility with mm-hmm. ownership. Now, to go to your question, I think that I don't know how much familiar you are with the projects under the new Partnership for African Development, but the projects that have been articulated under the infrastructure were intended to address some of the issues which is the point of the talk of to this radio. And in fact, I can tell you that there are now two programs. There is the short-term infrastructure program, which was developed with the help of the African Development Bank, and which the African Development Bank has put its own money worth the tune of $700 million and has mobilized another $1.6 million in form of credits and loan. So the fact of the matter is that the leaders recognize the importance of this issue and they're addressing it in the NEPA program.
And I don't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to give Stephen Morrison a chance to address this issue before we go. We just have about 30 seconds left or so.
Okay.
So, Stephen Morrison?
A couple of quick closing remarks. One is that this whole concern with infrastructure is getting much higher attention today. Commodity prices for oil and for minerals coming out of Africa are at historic levels. Those countries that are endowed have much higher resources to dedicate today towards infrastructure if they care to and they're committed to that. Those that are not endowed find themselves even more disadvantaged with much higher bills to pay. You have a reform movement within Africa itself. Our most recent caller put an emphasis on that,
mm-hmm.
where you have African leaders stepping forward and saying, we will reform, but we need help from donors, particularly in the poorest, in making the bid back onto infrastructure. And you have new instruments like the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the Chinese coming in, and the South African government putting a region-wide push on infrastructure development in Southern Africa.
Stephen Morrison, we want to thank you very much. He's the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Our thanks to Eloto Otobo, Chief of Policy Analysis in the Monitoring Unit of the Special Advisor for Africa at the UN. This is NPR News.